So let's start out with the basic setting. Suppose that I have a bunch of vectors, v1 through vn, in d complex dimensions, or maybe also in real. And suppose that they satisfy the following. So the inner product of vi and vj, where this inner product is the Hermitian inner product if it's complex, and just the ordinary one, Euclidean one if it's real, that the absolute value squared of this inner product is either 1 if they're equal, so they're normalized, or it's some alpha, which is greater than 0, if I and j are not equal. Let's allow 0. Okay? So what does this tell us about n? So it's not hard to prove that for the reals, that n can be at most d squared plus d over 2. And that for the complexes, n can be at most d squared. And so how do we prove this? So suppose that we have vectors that satisfy this and define rank 1 projections, pi, vi, vi dagger. Okay, and then let's form the Gram matrix. Trace of pi, pj. This is some n by n matrix. And let's take its determinant. And that equals one minus alpha to the n minus 1. So what's this matrix look like? It looks like you've got 1s on the diagonal and you've got alphas on the off diagonals. And so it was that times 1 plus n minus 1 alpha. But so this alpha should satisfy somewhere between 0 and 1, but it's never equal to 1, because we're not going to assume that these vectors are distinct. And so that implies that this Gram matrix has a positive determinant. And so that implies that these guys, as vectors in either the Hermitian matrices, d by d, or the symmetric matrices, or the reals, that they're linearly independent. So in turn, that implies that n is less than or equal to the dimension of the Hermitian or symmetric matrices. Okay? And then that's what these numbers are here. So it's a very easy to prove upper bound. And so going back to maybe the late 60s and early 70s, there was a lot of work on constructing such configurations in real space. So notice that we're looking at the absolute value squared here. So in particular, v and minus v, they span the same line, okay? Or in complex space, it's v times any phase spans the same line. So what sets of vectors that satisfy this correspond to is sets of equal angular lines. And if you can find a set that achieves this bound, then it's maximal. So it turns out that in the real case, so for real, n equals d squared plus d over 2 is only possible when d equals 3 or it's a square minus 2. Okay, so for example, so this includes the case d equals 2, which just corresponds to these three lines. Okay, so d equals 3 corresponds to, if you take the 12 vertices of an icosahedron and you take the 6 lines that go through those. So this would be like the top of an icosahedron. And if you take the lines that go through these guys, if you put that on a sphere, okay, you get a maximal set in dimension 3. But this bound is not always achieved in general, and I won't get into the proof of how you show that. No. So on the other hand, and I'll mention that these constructions actually come, there's explicit constructions that use the theory of like strongly regular graphs. And the point is if you remove this middle vertex, you get a strongly regular graph. And there's various attempts at generalizing this to the complex case, but it gets a lot more tricky. So, but it turns out that for C, n equals d squared is always achievable. And I'll put quotes there, because we don't have a proof yet, but there's a ton of circumstantial evidence that I guess initially kind of started out with numeric evidence, as in, you know, doing some numeric optimization to find these vectors. But then there's also computer-assisted proofs in very, very high dimensions using the computer algebra software Magma that constructs them explicitly. And I think these dimensions go as high as very recently, Grossel and Scott constructed one in dimension 323. And the numerics go as high as 844. And I'll tell you a little bit about what those numbers, why those particular numbers are relevant in a little while. So let's just give an example. So example for d equals 2. So the easiest, so for d equals 2, the complex projective Hilbert space is just the points on a sphere. Okay, so if I take a cube and I inscribe this into a sphere, and if I take a tetrahedron inside there, maybe this point in the back, imagine this sitting inside of a complex projective line. This gives me a set of four equiangular complex lines. I should also add that always achievable, in which case alpha has to be 1 over d plus 1. So what do these look like mathematically? Well, if you write this out in terms of the usual Pauli matrices, so x is then I can write this projector, let's just call it P0, 1/2 identity plus root 1 over root 3 x plus y plus z. And then the way that you get from this one to the other ones is you could call P1 x, P0 x, P2 y, p0, y, and p3, z, p0, z. So these are all in orbit of, under the Pauli group of this one particular projector here, which people tend to call this fiducial in the literature on this problem. So this Pauli group's non-commutative, but you see it's just acting projectively. So really what we have is an orbit of Z2 cross Z2, the Klein 4 group. Okay. You also notice that there's a nice symmetry each one of these guys satisfies, because you can, what you have is you have the symmetry group of the cube, also known as the octahedral group. And so this has these order 3 symmetries about each point. And actually, these guys are singled out exactly by this order 3 symmetry. And so kind of one of the great miracles about this problem is that this picture seems to completely generalize to all higher complex dimensions, where you define the generalized Pauli matrices. So you have this cyclic shift, then you have this matrix with dth roots of unity on the diagonal, where that guy there is e to the 2 pi I over d. And apparently there always exists some V0 such that the vectors x to the, say, j1, c to the j2, v0, call this Vj, such that these guys form a maximal set of complex, or they span a maximal set of complex equiangular lines. So people kind of discovered this numerically, maybe in a sense because these are natural matrices to consider in quantum information theory. They play a role in the theory of quantum error correction for non-binary systems, rather than working with qubits, if you work with qdits for some d. And actually, it can even be used to kind of, when d is very large, to, you know, the symmetries of this group, you know, give rise to things like the quantum Fourier transform. So mathematically, what these guys do is that they generate essentially a Heisenberg group. So you have a central extension, say U1. Let me just put D's here. Of ZD cross ZD. And every projective representation of this guy lifts to a linear representation of this, okay, or at least the specific one that we care about here. And it turns out that this order three symmetry, so the symmetry group of the cube is actually an extension of the Klein 4 group, which winds up being, so what you have is that you have SL2 mod 2 semi-direct the symmetry group of this is an extension of this group by this right here. And it's kind of like a discrete analog of the type of group people study in quantum mechanics, where if you have like R2 acted on by the symplectic group. So various people, maybe starting with Gerhard Zauner, wrote a PhD thesis in German in the late 90s that constructed these both numerically and algebraically in some dimensions up to, say, 10. Then there was a paper by Rennes, Blumkehout, Caves, and Scott. Chris Fuchs also worked with them on this, that maybe pushed the numerical constructions up to about dimension 30 and constructed some new explicit algebraic ones. Then there was a really amazing paper by Scott and Grossel where they actually solved the algebraic equations that come out of requiring that you get an equiangular orbit under this group. And they found numerical solutions in every dimension up to 67 and explicit algebraic solutions in dimensions, I think, 2 through 16, then 19, 24, 35, and 48. This was Scott and Grossel in 09. And so this is explicit over number fields in Magma, which is a computer algebra package. And then they were even so nice as to compute the Galois closures of these fields and to tell us what the Galois groups were. And they all wound up having a nice form that I'll get to in a bit. In recent years, there's been kind of an explosion of activity in the last few months even on this. And so let me just see if I can tell you how this works. So they did all this, and then they did numerical. Up to 67. And since then, Scott and Grossel again extended this up to 21, or 121. So that's all. And this is Scott, or Grossel Scott 17. And they actually obtained algebraic, I'll just say explicit. For D going, let's see, for 4, 8, 19, 48. So these were already known. But then the new ones, 121 and 323. And then they actually pushed this all the way up to 844. And it turns out that all these numbers have something in common, which I'll get to. But I mean, how does one go for finding either, you know, either explicit or numerical solutions to these things? So it turns out that that you can kind of pull some equations out of this that tell you that these vectors that you're looking for live in some real algebraic subvariety, real projective subvariety of complex projective space. And the way that it works is this. So write down these formulas. Sum over, let me just check my notes. Sum over k of zk bk plus I bar bk plus j bar zk plus I plus j minus delta I plus delta j. These are just Dirac delta functions or Kronecker deltas or d plus 1 times the norm squared squared. Okay, so these are homogeneous polynomials of degree 2 comma 2 in variables, you know, zk and zk bar. But then you also have to, so there's d squared equations for I, j going from 0 to d minus 1. And then you also need d more. It says that zk bar equals zk complex conjugate. So you're taking some kind of real hypersurface of this complex algebraic variety in twice as many dimensions as if you take the real and imaginary parts and treat those as separate variables. And so they basically took these guys and solved them using some Grobner basis techniques. And that's how they were able to get these explicit solutions. But they also took advantage of symmetries that were observed that generalize this order 3 symmetry here to higher dimensions. And so before I say how that works, I want to say how the numerics work. So there's a completely dual problem to this one of finding equiangular lines. And it's the notion of a complex projective 2 design. So you may have heard of spherical designs. This is where if you have, you know, some finite set of points on the sphere that you want to integrate polynomial functions by averaging them over these points. And so a spherical T design is something that gives you kind of perfect cubature for all homogeneous polynomials in degree up to T. That would be a spherical T design. And so there's a relaxation of this where you, there's kind of two different ways to look at it. One way is that if you take a complex sphere, this lives in twice as many real dimensions, and you only require that, that you work well in integrating certain functions that are kind of a subclass of the harmonic functions. But rather than kind of go into that theory, I'll just kind of write down an explicit description of what we mean. So let me call this operator here. Well, I'll just write it this way. So let delta or zeta 2d minus j1, j2, x d to the j1, x d to the j2, sorry, z. Call this delta sub j. So what this amounts to is a particular splitting of this sequence here. And the way I've defined it this way is that it makes things work out a little nicer when the dimension d is odd. And in the sense that the automorphism group of the Heisenberg group acts in kind of a natural way by conjugating on matrices. And so if you then have some P, some projector, and you consider taking the sum over J and ZD squared of delta J dagger, tensor it twice, that you want this to equal 2 over d squared plus d times the projector onto the symmetric subspace in 2 tensor copies of CD. Okay? So, or I should say in general, so this should be what, 1 over d squared. And it turns out that, well, I can define this more generally in terms of 1 over n sum over pi tensor pi. And that should equal this. We'll just call that our definition of, so just to be precise, so p1 through pn such that that equals this is a complex projective 2 design. And so it turns out that a complex 2 design needs to have some minimal cardinality. And one can prove that a complex projective 2 design has to have at least d squared elements. And it also turns out that if you have a set of complex equiangular lines of the minimal possible cardinality, that it actually corresponds to, or sorry, the maximal possible cardinality, it corresponds to a complex projective 2 design of the minimal possible cardinality. So a way of looking for these guys numerically is to kind of, you know, optimize over, put some vector here, and take the norm of this guy. Right? Because this thing here where it just equals trace of A squared on Hermitian matrices. And so, roughly speaking, this is how they found these things numerically. And then, so it turns out that if we go back to this picture here, that if you take this as a subgroup of UD, and you consider the set of all or the group of all automorphisms of this group here, so this is actually a Heisenberg group called HD. So if you take the group of all automorphisms that fix the center of this, that this gives you a projective representation of, so take fixing center, it gives a projective representation of SL2D. And this is something that in math is known as the Weyl representation associated to this Heisenberg group. And in quantum computing, people call this a generalized Clifford group. Although technically, Clifford algebras only have something to do with this in the case where, you know, where you work with something like SP2 on F2 to the n. So for like codes over qubits. So it's kind of not a good notation for, or not a good word for what this is in general, but it's kind of what people call it. And so under this projective representation, which actually I can kind of define explicitly, the way it works is this. So if I take these operators here, and so assume D is odd for simplicity, then G in SL2D acts via GJ. And actually, you can find explicit unitaries, UG, that act by conjugation. And if D is even, there's some signs that come up, and this has something to do with fermions that I don't want to get into. So it turns out that there always exists an order 3 element in this group that's basically, I mean, it's related to like ST squared, where S is this guy, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, and T is 1, 0, 0, 1. Sorry, 1. So like in terms of the, you know, the group of modular transformations, because essentially these ones, so SL2D, you have a map from SL2Z into there with kernel this principal congruent subgroup. So it's just a quotient of this by that. And so these guys are defined for every D, it turns out. And so what Scott and Grossel had done was they took these numerical solutions that they were finding. So I should also mention one more thing, that it turns out that if the dimension is not 3, and we can't prove this, but it turns out that this variety is zero-dimensional. For D not equal to 3. And I say turns out in the sense that when they compute, you know, these numerical solutions, that they find that they're always isolated. And that's kind of what makes it hard, right? Because you basically are forced to have to like explicitly construct them. You can't just use kind of genericity results or something. And so, let's see, so where do I want to go next? So a lot of these higher dimensional ones that they found that there was actually some bigger symmetry group, which always winds up being a cyclic subgroup of SL2D. And then so they could kind of reduce the search down to a particular eigenspace that they were able to predict kind of from inspection. And then that kind of luckily reduced the search so that they could hit these higher ones, like in dimension 48. But it wasn't really clear why these symmetries existed. So maybe now I'll say a little bit more about what Scott and Grossel had done. For that, I want to kind of give a little bit of background on what number fields are and algebraic numbers. So not only did these solutions wind up being isolated, but they wind up being algebraic. And so a number A is algebraic if it's the root of some polynomial with integer coefficients. And what the nice thing about algebraic numbers is that you can represent them exactly in a computer, and you can do arithmetic with them, and you don't have to worry about round-off errors. So if one constructs a solution or vectors whose coordinates live in, you know, are algebraic numbers, then it's possible to consider this to be a proof of the existence. Okay, so a number field is generated by some roots of an irreducible polynomial. So by irreducible, this means that you can't factor it into other polynomials over the integers. And you can also talk about, so let's call this F, you know, for like a number field. And moreover, if I have some number field like K, I can talk about extensions. Well, before I do that, let me just give some examples. So for example, let's let F be, take the rationals, and stick in the square root of some number. This is called a quadratic number field. And if, or it's some integer, let's say, square free, or at least not having, such that the square root is not an integer, let's say. And if M is positive, it's called a real quadratic field. And if it's negative, it's called an imaginary quadratic field. These kind of generalize, so the relationship, we write this as this over Q to mean it's an extension of Q. And these generalize the notion of, say, the complex numbers over the reals. So like in this case, there's a symmetry that takes, you know, square root of m to minus square root of m. That's analogous to conjugation here. So another one would be cyclotomic fields. Take the rationals, and you consider all polynomials in some dth root of unity. And so these ones show up a lot in physics, and they're already showing up in this problem, right? Because we had dth roots of unity up here. And it also turns out that you can represent this Weyl representation all using matrices over the D of cyclotomic field, or maybe 2D, let's say, which when D is odd, actually it turns out that you don't need to go bigger. But so, Yeah, so we'll say that a number field is Galois. Well, more generally, if we have an extension of fields, okay, this means that it's generated by roots of some polynomial f over the base field. Okay, so if actually for here I could have put Q. Doesn't make a difference because you can clear denominators, you get the same roots. And it's Galois, so this is called Galois, or normal, if generated by all the roots of this. And the reason it's nice to work with number fields that are Galois or normal is that there's a nice group action by something called the Galois group, which winds up being equal to the automorphism group of the field. And what it does is it acts by permutations on these roots. And you know, there's a nice, beautiful theory of Galois extensions, and it's kind of, you can always embed any field into a Galois closure by just taking all the rest of the roots, although the degree could blow up exponentially, right, because the symmetric group is big. And it also turns out that if a field is Galois, then the order of this group is equal to the degree of the base field. So when Scott and Grosso wrote their paper in 2009, they told us what the Galois groups of the number field over which these solutions live or are generated by is given, is equal to. And they found that the Galois group, so this guy here is, let's say, the minimal field that over which you can write these vectors, that it always looks like some abelian group semi-direct Z2. So in particular, that means that they're not defined over cyclotomic fields, okay, because the Galois group of a cyclotomic field is isomorphic to the group of units in the ring Z mod D. These are just all the numbers that have a GCD of 1 with D, relatively prime to D. And the way that these work is there's a nice explicit way to describe how the Galois group of a cyclotomic field acts. Namely, you know, if A is in here, then it goes to the automorphism that takes the dth root of unity to its aeth power. So there's a very kind of explicit manner in which the Galois group acts on the generators of these types of fields. So in this case here, so there's a certain sense in which abelian extensions of quadratic fields, kind of a very classical topic in algebraic number theory. And that's of the case where, so what does this mean? We just say that it tells us that the Galois group is an extension, or it lies in an extension of the Galois group of some quadratic field or quadratic subfield. Where this here, so where K is some Q square root of M that lives inside of F. And it also tells us that this field, that this extension splits. Okay. So when I learned this back in 2009, I thought, well, I know that there's this beautiful theory of complex multiplication, where one can find explicit generators. I mean, I knew about it, decided to learn about it because I thought that's how it would solve this problem. And roughly speaking, the way that it works is that, so these numbers here are obtained by, you take some analytic function, which is the exponential function, and you evaluate it at the torsion points on some circle. And kind of the miracle, which is not so miraculous here, is that when you take this analytic function, this transcendental function, and you evaluate these points, you get algebraic numbers. And so there's a generalization of this to higher dimensions, where you replace the circle with an elliptic curve. Okay, and so roughly speaking, if you take, I'll say a bit more about number theory. So these are algebraic numbers. So an algebraic integer is the root of a monic polynomial. And here I really do need the integers here. And what monic means is that the highest degree term is 1. Okay, so that kind of sets the scale. Okay, so it's something like x to the n plus an minus 1 to n minus 1 plus a0. Okay, so algebraic integers, they form a subring of this. And in some sense, they're actually like the original rings. Just the first kind of abstract rings that people were studying was, you know, rings of algebraic integers, also sometimes called number rings. And it turns out that in every number field, if you take all the algebraic integers in there, that this forms a generalization of the ordinary integers. So call that, so OK in K. Sometimes people write Z sub K. It's like an integral extension. And let's see. So in an imaginary quadratic field, these guys correspond to sublattices of the complex numbers. And so if I take K, let's say, for example, take K equal 2, join the square root of minus 1, then OK actually is just Z adjoining the square root of minus 1. So in the complex plane, it's just some regular square lattice. Okay, and so that would be this. And then so if I take C mod OK, this gives me a complex torus. But it winds up being an elliptic curve that has some natural symmetries that come from the algebra in here. And so it's possible to write down explicit analytic functions, I won't really do here, such that if you evaluate on kind of a denser lattice, that you get algebraic numbers that generate all the abelian extensions of a given quadratic number field. So an extension's abelian if in an extension like this, if this is an abelian group, abelian extension. And so this sort of has all the right components that smell right for this problem, right? Because like if you take, you know, if you have some lattice and you mod it out by, you know, 1 over n times the lattice, this is going to be, you know, as a group, it'll look like z mod n to the rank of the lattice. And so for rank 2 lattices, that gives us this underlying group here, if you take the right torsion points. But, and I you know, worked on this and tried to find examples of what would be the correct quadratic field to take, right? Because, you know, a number field can be realized as an abelian extension of several different, you know, quadratic number fields that live inside of it, and with sort of a limited number of you know, algebraic or explicit examples to work with, I never really was able to find a pattern. But then I learned some years later about a conjecture by Appleby that was written up in a paper and, you know, analyzed in great detail in a paper by Appleby and Zauner. It's the only other paper that Zauner wrote on this problem. And so they conjectured that this is the relevant field, Q adjoining the square root of d minus 3, d plus 1. So this is both super interesting and kind of depressing, because much, much less is known about how to construct abelian extensions of these types of fields. So while there's this beautiful theory of complex multiplication that works not only in the case where the base field is imaginary quadratic, but where it's something called a CM field, which is a totally imaginary extension of a totally real number field. And what's nice about CM fields is that they have a unique complex conjugation no matter how you put them into the complex numbers. For fields that are base fields that are not CM, there's little known. I mean, in some sense, I think because the connection to complex analysis is less clear. So kind of shortly after this, maybe a little before their paper came out, I actually managed to formulate a conjecture for what the specific extensions were. So I conjectured that these are something called the Ray class field over K with conductor D prime infinity, where D prime is D if D is odd, and 2D if D is even. So what is this? Okay, so if I have a number field K with a ring of integers, okay, there's a notion of ideals in this ring, and the ideals are kind of like generalizations of subspaces. Okay, so I have an ideal in here, it factors uniquely into prime ideals. I equals P1, P2, PM. These guys are prime ideals. And it just means that these can't factor any further. I mean, the one definition is that if X, Y is in P, this implies that either X is in P or Y is in P. And if I take a prime ideal, so if I take okay, mod a prime ideal, this is a field, finite field with, say, q elements. And so now let's say that I have an extension of my field. Well, then it turns out that if I extend the, you know, by the ring of integers in the extension, times this prime, it factors further into some like Q1 through Qn. And let's just assume this is Galois. And it actually looks like this. So there's some, this is called the ramification index. And it turns out that for all but a finite number of prime ideals, this is one. And these, many people call these the bad primes in some sense. And then so the way that this works is that then if I take OF mod one of these guys, this is another finite field with I don't want to say this Q to the F element if this has Q. And so that guy, this is an extension of FQ. And it's Galois, with its Galois group being just Z mod F. And so let's say that there's G of these. And then so it turns out that in that case, that the degree of this extension, call it n, equals e times f times g. Okay, so this is the ramification degree. This is the number of primes that you get. And this is called the residue class degree. And so so there's a notion of a modulus in K, which is some product of it's a product of an ideal of K, formal product, times some number of embeddings of k into the reals. Okay. These are called the real places, and these are just called the finite places. And so we usually write a modulus that's like math frac m. And so we make some definitions. So this is the group of all ideals, of all fractional ideals in K. I mean, these are rank one OK submodules of K. And these are the ones that are prime to, so we write this as M0, M infinity, where this here is an ideal, and this is some product of, formal product of real embeddings. And so this is the group of fractional ideals prime to M0. And then we define a subgroup of that, P M1K. This is the principal ones. Prime to M0. So they're principal, so they're generated by some alpha, let's say. Let's say A. And such that A is congruent to 1 mod M. And so what that means is that it's congruent to 1 mod the prime ideal part, but that it's also positive under all the real embeddings in here. And then one can define a notion of an ideal group mod M. So what this is you take this PM1 of K, you take it times the image of the norm map under the ideals of F that are prime to this, you know, to the finite part of this modulus. And what this norm map is it's a product over all automorphisms in the Galois group. So it takes a prime ideal, let's say, to product of all the automorphisms in that Galois group. And that's basically it for the definitions. And then so Weber, who was really kind of one of the first people that was working on, you know, a general theory of class field theory. And well, I'll give the definition first before I say some more history. So he proved, so if M is a modulus in K, and if F over K is Galois, then the index of this ideal group, or of this generalized, of this guy here, in the whole ideal group, gives you a lower bound to the degree of the extension. And then he defined, so now we get a definition. He defined F over K is a class field if there exists a modulus in K such that that is equality. And then such an M is called admissible for this extension. So a Galois extension is a class field if it has an admissible modulus. And it turns out that if it has an admissible modulus, these are all partially ordered, then you can find a unique minimal one. It's called the conductor. Okay. Of that. Okay. So on the other hand, it's also possible to prove that if F over K is abelian, then the same inequality holds, but going the other way. So this actually implies that every abelian extension is a class field in this notion. But there's also, one can talk about non-abelian class fields. And these have something to do with the Langlands program that I can't really explain to you because I don't understand it. So then the Ray class field, so just to finish writing the definition, Ray class field is a maximal field with a given modulus. So the Ray class field, I'll write that K super M, which is unique up to isomorphism, is a maximal class field with modulus M. So if we go all the way back to this thing I wrote over here, so this is just a principal ideal generated by D prime. And this is the product of the two real embeddings of this base field K, which is real quadratic. So we had to go through this whole roundabout way to define what a class field is in general. So why do this? So kind of in the early days, as I alluded to, people had these explicit ways of generating these fields. And sometimes they found these in nature and then developed class field theory in order to explain these and to try to generalize them. So this is actually the content of Hilbert's 12th problem, which looks for kind of a similarly explicit way for generating the class fields of arbitrary fields. And it's also known as Kronecker's Jugendstrom. Not sure if I said that right. His dearest dream of youth, which was maybe less ambitious than what Hilbert wanted to do. So in some sense, trying to make sense out of generalizing a lot of this stuff was what drove a lot of the development of modern number theory. And so there's various theorems that can be proved in class field theory, such as that for every modulus, there exists a Ray class field. So you actually have to prove this. And that if you take a bigger modulus, that you get a bigger field. You can prove that every abelian extension lives in some Ray class field, right? Because an abelian extension has an admissible modulus. And so it lives as a subfield of a Ray class field with respect to that modulus. But the issue is that like the way that these fields are proved to exist is very kind of roundabout and abstract. So one generally proves the existence of enough extensions to force this one to exist. You prove that some bigger field exists and find it as a sub extension, or more modern techniques kind of do things p-adically and prove local class field theory for local fields where you kind of complete different primes and you have to put it all together in the end. But on the other hand, what we found is that for this problem here, so maybe I should be a little more precise about what this conjecture was and what we know about it now. So I had noticed that in each dimension that there was a number of solutions and that the one whose field, one that generated a field of minimal degree was exactly this Ray class field. And I kind of just noticed this by checking the Galois groups, which you can compute explicitly from class field theory calculations. But that the other ones seemed to contain it. Or be extensions of it, let's say. So in a recent collaboration with Appleby, Flamia, and McConnell, so we actually, mostly they, checked this stuff explicitly in Magma, in the sense that you can ask Magma to construct a Ray class field and to check to see if there's an isomorphism you know, into it, you know, from, or let's say, from that field into the, some other field of interest that you've constructed. And so they checked it, and it always works. And it seems that in each dimension that there's a finite number of fields that, that wind up being, in some cases, you know, small extensions of these ray class fields. And as far as I know, we don't have an explicit conjecture for what those other fields are, but I have some ideas. And let's see, so maybe just to end on a on maybe a more speculative note, so it would be nice to find some analog of the analytic functions that show up in the complex multiplication theory for this problem. And so as far as I know, I have a 20-year-old string theory paper by Greg Moore called Arithmetic and the Tractors that I'm trying to penetrate. And apparently he conjectures that for n equals 2 supersymmetric black holes in type 2B string theory, that there's some way that these fields that Hilbert was, that these analytic functions that Hilbert was looking for might somehow come from the image of a mirror map. So if any of you guys understand that stuff and want to explain it to me, that'd be great. But he's also kind of, he doesn't really say what the fields are that come up for these different kinds of black holes. And so, I mean, at least I couldn't find it in his paper. But I also don't know if maybe there's been activity on this in the last 20 years. I mean, in some sense, I started trying to learn class field theory in order to, or not the other CFT, conformal field theory, in order to, you know, try to make some sense, you know, find some math that would help with this problem. But that was back when I thought that it was, that, you know, that these were Abelian extensions of imaginary quadratics. So in this real case, it's much less clear. So I guess in Moore's paper, he says that if you have more supersymmetry, that you actually get Abelian extensions of imaginary quadratics, like n equals 4 and n equals 8. He has kind of explicit constructions using elliptic curves with complex multiplication. But then there's at some point he takes more general Calabi-Yau threefolds. And as far as I know, this could go kind of way beyond even that, right? So, but maybe some tricks or ideas from, you know, or some generalization, because maybe you don't need the normal constraints that you have in string theory in order to construct these sorts of things. And you know, given the fact that, so maybe I should just end with, I kind of didn't really clarify. So the title of this talk is Quantum Measurements. You might be wondering, what the hell does any of this have to do with quantum measurements? So if I take these vectors, these v1 through vd squared, and if I form projectors, pi, vi, vi dagger, then if I take the sum over I of 1 over d, pi, this equals the identity matrix. And so in quantum information theory, anytime I have some sum over operators, let's say ai equals I, where each ai is positive semi-definite, this describes, this defines something called a POVM, or a positive operator value measure. And it's just a, there's more general cases where you don't sum, so maybe measure's overkill here, but the idea is that if I have some subset of 1 through d squared, I can define an operator AS, which is just the sum over I in S of AI. So this is a measure on this finite set that takes values in the set of positive operators. And if you have a density matrix, rho, so this is some Hermitian matrix that is positive semi-definite, and trace of rho equals 1, that, and if I do a quantum measurement that has d squared possible outcomes, the probability of the outcomes in the set S, so the probability that I is in S equals the trace of rho against this operator. So, and this was actually, so the original paper, or the second original paper by Rennes et al., they called these things sick POVMs. Not because it makes you sick to work on it, but because it stands for symmetric, informationally complete positive operator value measures. So they're informationally complete in the sense that you have d squared of them, and the real dimension of the space of Hermitian matrices is d squared. So it's kind of the minimal number that you need to do in order to do tomography. And they're symmetric for obvious reasons, because this trace of pi, pj equals 1 over d plus 1. So it's kind of something, I guess they were thinking, wouldn't it be nice if we had these? And they thought, well, we know we have these generalized Paulis that seems to scramble things up in nice ways. Maybe we can find some vectors that have this property. And they found them. But then people have been having a hard time proving that they exist. And I think that this fact that you essentially need unsolved things in class field theory in order to explicitly construct them is some indication for why the problem is hard. So I guess I used the hour, so I'll stop. Thanks.
Any questions? So knowing that all of the numbers that come up in finding the solutions lie in a particular number field, how does that help you actually constructing?
It doesn't really, is the thing. One might hope. Mm-hmm. But I think what it does is it shows you that if it's hard to find explicit generators of these fields, mm-hmm. and if they happen to come naturally out of the solutions of this problem, mm-hmm. then you're actually up against the problem of constructing explicit generators for these fields, which is a hard problem. So I mean, maybe I could say a tiny bit more, which is that, like, if you take these delta i's or these delta j's, right, and if I take the trace of that against this projector, this gives me some function on ZD cross ZD. And it's these numbers that are the generators. And actually, sometimes these generators are slightly smaller field, but maybe if you put in, so if you call this, let's say, Q of P, if you also put in this root of unity, it gives you the field exactly. I mean, I could say a lot more about the structure of this and how the class field theory works, but another hour. I'll save that for when I finish solving it.
So when you say solving it, like, what is that actually? Like, what is the entail? The entail is knowing the generators explicitly, or like,
well, I would like, I mean,
what's sufficient, right?
I mean, I would like to. I mean, so okay. Well, I guess so. There's one more thing I promised to tell you that I didn't tell you, which is where these weird numbers come from. Okay, so maybe I should mention this too. So if I have a real quadratic field, if I have A equals 2, and so okay, this is some ring that kind of looks like, it either looks like Z root m or Z 1 plus root m over 2, depending on the value of 1 mod 4. And the unit group of this guy, it winds up being generated by minus 1 in something called the fundamental unit. And sometimes the fundamental unit is positive under both embeddings, sometimes it's not. So let u plus be the smallest power, it's positive, so it's either equal to uf or uf squared. And then if I take u plus to the r plus u plus to the minus r plus 1, this equals some d. And it turns out that for a given base field, you can enumerate. So this is something that was shown in my paper with Flumia et al, Rappleby et al, that you get towers of dimensions over each possible quadratic number field that fills out all the different dimensions that have that as a base field. And so, like, for example, these weird dimensions that Grassel and Scott found are the ones that correspond to the case where uf is 1 plus root 5 over 2. And it turns out that this is not totally positive, right? Because if I replace this with minus that, it goes negative. So you have to square it. Uf squared equals u plus equals 3 plus root 5 over 2. So now this is totally positive. And then if you take the number, if you plug that into here, you get some sequence. So you get d equals 4, 8, 19, 48, 124, 323, 844, and so on. And I mean, they really, I don't know if they put it on like a cluster or what to kind of compute this one, but it's some huge, huge degree field into like the tens of thousands or something. And I'm not really sure why. putting this effort in, because to my mind, we don't really even understand the base ones in a sense. I mean, yeah, you can calculate it on a computer, but there are certain algebraic symmetries that show up that I didn't get into that basically relate the Galois action on a fiducial vector or a fiducial projector to a unitary group action that comes from this Vey representation. And I conjecture that it's somehow closely related to a Galois, or non-commutative Galois 1 cocycle. But it doesn't quite work out. But I think that there's maybe some slight twist of it that may work out. So like, I don't even feel comfortable with the relatively low-dimensional solutions in, say, D equals 4. Or I mean, one of the cases I'm looking at is actually prime dimensions that are 1 mod 12, because a bunch of things about the class field theory simplify. And I think like if I could somehow prove it in dimension 5, I'll have an infinite series. Because like the same arguments would just generalize. So that's ongoing.
So what you said the Ray class field K with the modulus is maximal. In what sense is
it's the maximal class field that has that conductor. So every class field with that conductor is contained in that Ray class field.
Okay.
So maybe an example I should have said during all this is that Q D prime is the Ray class field over Q with conductor D prime infinity, where this is the only embedding of Q. And actually, if you get rid of this guy, then it winds up being Q D prime plus D prime inverse, which is the real subfield of that.
Suppose somebody gave you an explicit basis of the Ray class field. Could you then solve your problem?
Like, you mean explicit set of generators?
Yeah.
I mean, one can compute them. But the thing is that the ones that come out of this problem seem much better than the ones that are computed by other existing algorithms. Kind of the way that these things work is that like there's sort of heuristic algorithms built into, say, Magma that compute generators for various sub-extensions, and then they take some compositum of them together. Then the degree can blow up when you compute these composita. But at some point in playing around with this stuff, I kind of found that the degrees of the polynomials that I get are, or not the degrees, but the size of the coefficients are way smaller. So this can probably somehow be quantified using the theory of heights, but I haven't really done it. So these really may be kind of like optimal generators for these fields in some sense.
Any further questions? Why don't we thank John again?
Okay.